Gavin Robertson, some have and some haven't. Some haven't and will, and some haven't and never will. What makes a performer decide that they're willing and able to stand on the stage on their own for an hour in front of an audience?
Well, in my case, a combination of two things. One, it was the artistic challenge of going, can I actually do that? Can I stand on a stage on my own and tell a story and hold an audience's attention for that long and not get anything particularly wrong? That was one thing. So just the artistic challenge. And the other thing was the idea of having an idea, a theme for a show, and really wanting to follow that through from the thought process to realizing it physically on stage. So it was a happy coincidence that those two things came along, and that was Crusoe, which I'm presenting here this year.
But the ones that haven't and never will would say to me on interview that they couldn't ever imagine doing it, and that, you know, the fear, and you know, so I guess there's something about being able to be solo on stage. Have you learned to be solo in other ways? I mean, do you need to be able to be comfortable with yourself, not in relation to other actors, to be able to do this work?
Yes, I wouldn't say it's an arrogance, but I think there's certainly a level of confidence. I mean, I was terrified, don't get me wrong, when I decided I was going to do Crusoe. And the reason it's Crusoe is that one of the challenges I wanted to do a solo show was to not have to stand on stage and sort of pretend to be four or five different characters. Now, I know that that's a conventional way of performing a solo show, but I wanted to find something which lent itself to being one person on its own, and that's why I discovered Crusoe. Now, it's not the story of Robinson Crusoe. It's a motif for three characters who are all on their own, but they don't talk to each other, or very, very rarely. So the idea itself, I spent quite a long time trying to come up with, you know, what lends itself to me being on my own. But yes, I think you have to be... it's feel the fear and do it anyway. That's really what it comes down to. I was absolutely petrified the first time I did it. In fact, the very first time I performed it, I missed out two scenes just through sheer nerves and, you know, a gentle kind of panic. But and I still really prepare myself for this particular show. I mean, you know, I did last year, I have a solo show called Bond, an unauthorized parody, and that's easier because it's comedy, which also means if things do go slightly wrong, and they do, you can the relationship with the audience is different. You can sort of almost admit it or declare it or get over it. Crusoe is quite philosophical in its nature, and so that's not the sort of show where I can make a joke or just walk through it. I have to actually concentrate on what I'm saying and what I'm trying to get over to the audience. So, yeah, even now I have a slight edge to my performance when I do that show.
And apart from, as Pip Upton says, the profit share's better, what are the unique rewards, either physical, spiritual, emotional, that come from being on stage on your own compared to doing that work with others?
Well, I suppose that, you know, yeah, okay, one small aspect is the financial, but that's a very, you know, back of the head kind of realization. For me, it's actually about the joy of saying, it's standing or falling on your own name, on your own performance. You know, I produced it, I wrote it. I mean, I had a director, of course, Nick Collett, but the idea is mine, the characters are mine, the writing is mine. And if I do a good performance and people like it, then that's actually really rewarding. That's the best reward. And also, I'm quite happy because I like the show, that if somebody doesn't like it, I'm not sort of offended. And maybe that's a sort of slightly innate confidence about going, well, that's fine. You have to realize you can't please everyone in an audience. People buy a ticket because they like the sound of what they think they're going to see. If they eventually turn up and don't like it, that's fine. I'm happy to debate that if anyone wants to talk to me. And sometimes those conversations are more interesting. We all like being told that we're great and fantastic and what an excellent show. But sometimes the conversations you have with somebody who didn't get it, or and you have to concentrate in my show. There are plenty of people, particularly in America, who had to see it more than once, you know, and it's a bit like that kind of show. It's a see it twice show. So yeah, for me the rewards are the debate afterwards and the fact that you can take all the credit. Sounds is not quite what I mean, but it goes directly back to you, so that's really exciting to find out what people's reaction is to basically what you've put up there and what you've just performed.
Now, and of course, with other actors, you've mentioned about there's a vulnerability. You can share the vulnerability, and I guess the more actors, you can share it quite well and spread it. I mean, do you get off on the vulnerability?
No, I wouldn't say I do. That scares me. That's the area where you think, oh my goodness, you know, what are people going to think? And, you know, please don't have me. I mean, we've all done it. If you're a solo performer, I guarantee that there will be some show where you've stood on stage and go, what the hell comes next? What's the next bit? And that's terrifying, and that's never a pleasure. But I think the kind of confidence as a performer comes with knowing ahead of that, that if it happens, I'll get out of it. I mean, you have to get out of it. There's absolutely no option, however awful it might be.
There's no one to bounce off, is there?
No, there literally isn't anyone to bounce off, except your technician, and they can't really do anything, you know. That's why if you direct a show and then you watch the show in the audience, the worst thing is being the director, because you have, at that moment, throughout that show, you're utterly helpless. And I hate that. I mean, I'm probably a control freak, you know. That's not why I make my own solo work. That was a different challenge. But there is an element of enjoy. I enjoy having the control, from the, you know, design of the set to the lighting, and all that input is really about realising an idea and a vision that I've come up with. And I think that's brilliant, and must be why solo performers do what they do.
And I guess part of my experience, I'm sitting in the audience of a solo show, and I've sat in the audience of a few. And there is something sacred, almost archetypal, about the fact that we are about to bear witness to one person, which already feels like something different and special and dangerous. And in some cases, they play lots of characters, or they just deliver, you know, monologue. But that is absolutely diluted when there's two, whatever that uniqueness is. But I'm sitting there and I'm experiencing that sacredness and that wish for the audience to be part of whatever that, my God, there's one person who's able to do this. But equally, I'm sitting there on another occasion and there's the, oh my God, there's only one, because that person hasn't created that sacredness and we just wish there were a few more people to look at. What's the difference?
I think the difference might be almost when somebody walks on stage or you see them that very first opening 15, 20 seconds. There's almost a feeling of this person is going to satisfy something, and that might just be a charisma perhaps, or an authority about who you're looking at. All those, you know, Peter Brook talks about the space. When an audience come into a space, they're instantly subliminally aware of the space. Sometimes it can be the space you're in a fringe venue, which isn't very nice. You know, I saw a show the other day which I quite liked the show, but the space was just appalling. It looked like a room with black cloths in it. It was very uninspiring. So I think there are lots of things an audience member can react to before the show's, you know, 5 minutes underway that suggests to you that there's an authority about it, and I think that's a good word. An authority about the design, the lighting, the level of the music, you know, what's the first impression I'm getting, the performer themselves. And if they're lucky enough to have some kind of charisma, which really is an indefinable quality, so much the better, you know, then you'll forgive them as well if they get it wrong or if lights go out when they shouldn't, you know. You don't worry. The last thing an audience wants is to feel that we're on shaky ground. So I think that the most important thing is that you respect their authority and you relax and enjoy what you're about to receive, not worry on their behalf.
If I try and get a little bit, I'm going to be deliberately kind of primitive, but also detailed. So with Pip Hutton, I mean, this is the man. On our behalf, he's climbed into the skin of Hitler and presented him to us. He's now climbed into the skin of Margaret Thatcher, you know, and we see him ridiculous, scary. Clearly, it takes taking its toll on him to keep doing that. If you take Guy Masterson, he's learned the bloody whole thing. You know, and he's playing 80 characters with Gavin Robertson, and we reviewed Crusoe in an early form and still it got a good review. Is there something about him as a performer that on our behalf he's precise and he's on our behalf, he's caring about it right down to the precision of it in his fingertips, in the way he moves. There isn't a wasted second, that was in the review. So that seems to be your gesture on behalf of the audience, that you're not only on your own, but you're offering something that, you know, doesn't seem to have a moment wasted in it.
Yeah, well, I think thank you for that. I think that's a good observation. And I think if you go and see Nick Collett's show here, Nelson, that I directed, or if you see the other show I'm presenting, Mata Hari Female Spy with Catherine Hurst, those things are true in as much as, even if it's not me on stage, I do like and respond to precision, a certain amount of grace, a cleanliness, a clarity, where nothing is wasted. That, to me, is good theatre. And I also really do like to make an assumption on the part of my audience that they're already interested or they wouldn't be there. So it's not television, it's not spoon-fed. You know, if you don't pay attention, yes, you might lose the thread a little bit, but I quite like that. And I know it sounds arrogant, but I think isn't that what we're going to engage with in theatre? That's what keeps us on the edge of our seats or engrossed with the person or the emotion of the character at the time, is that we're interpreting what we're being given. So I really do like to feel that I meet the audience halfway, whether that's them watching me personally at the time or watching something I've directed. I mean, I have three solo shows up here, in effect, not as a producer, but certainly as somebody who's been involved with them, as a director, for two, as a writer for two, you know. So, but I'm quite curious, you know, obviously I don't really know, if somebody went and said, saw those three shows and said, well, Gavin Robertson is involved in all of those, what's his style? A bit like you've already said, yeah, I'd say precise and a sort of cleanliness, but it's hard for me to define what that is. That's for observers of my work to come back and tell me. I'd be quite interested to know what they thought that was.
Yeah, but I guess I'm also saying that, you know, even if we don't get it all, one thing you can't fail to pick up is, behind the scenes, to get that precise, there's a lot of bedding that in, isn't there?
Yeah, well, it's training. I mean, you know, there's a movement training there. I've been doing this style of work for a long time, and I think that you... that stuff pays off. You know, an audience sense that. That's a subliminal sort of element that I think I was talking about earlier, that they relax with your authority. And authority is not arrogance. Authority is about being comfortable and confident, you know, but in an empathic way. So that's what I definitely try and put across. I mean, I think Catherine Hirst is fantastic. You know, she has grace. She acts well. She is a truthful actress in terms of what she's portraying emotionally at the time.
That's in Mata Hari, Female Spy.
Yes, thanks. Yes, it is. And so, you know, that's a pleasure to direct somebody like that. You know, Nick is different. You know, I don't even know if he has a movement training as such, but he's a very good character actor. So when I'm directing Nick, I'm directing Nick. I'm not directing Nick in the way that I would do it if I were on stage doing it. So you're trying to relate to the people you're working with. And, you know, I put it in the Fringe Review blog, but I mean, you know, my mantra recently is, and I've been sharing it with a lot of people, particularly if they're younger, which is that, you know, make good work with good people. And I think if you do that, you're 75% of the way of producing that something people will want to see.
Just to make an appalling comparison of what you do with taxi driving, when you go on tour and, you know, it's just you and it's very intense and you're touring and performing again and again, how do you make sure, or you don't need to, that it's not just another job to the airport?
Well, I think those things are all wrapped up. I mean, you know, anybody who's ever sort of travelled a lot, whether you're in a business, you know, or you're lucky enough to go on holidays, or you have long drives to commutes to work, there's an element of it which is just not glamorous or interesting at all. You know, I mean, we've all done that driving thing where you go, I can't remember the journey, you know, I've got out. And that's dull and boring and, you know, tedious. But I think what we do as people who create work is that, you, when you go on stage to do whatever that show is, I mean, I was in America all of July doing three different shows. Well, one, I suppose, in that case, the variety kept it interesting. But I was doing Bond in three different cities, and that's just the, I suppose, the investment of yourself in your own work. You know, you want to present the best of yourself to whoever it is that's watching. So that's what, as a solo performer, that certainly keeps every show interesting for me. I've relaxed far more in shows in the West End, for example, if I've been in a cast of 12. You know, that can be dull. That's like a job, 8 shows a week for 3 months, and then you extend a bit. You know, there's no way I personally could pretend I was still interested in... It's not natural for anybody to say the same lines, to be in the same place, and emotionally potentially feel the same thing. You know, it's like that's like Groundhog Day.
Yeah. I guess what I'm also interested in, what often creates work and certainly then beds it in early and you develop it, is, as you brought to the Fringe a couple of years back, is uncertainty. And then you get good at it, and then you go into a mode of repetition. So if uncertainty is so important to the creative process, what happens when you've got so good that the uncertainty is gone?
Well, because you're then taking great pleasure in tiny, tiny details. I mean, you know, so I'm going to do Crusoe in about an hour. And I'm looking forward to it today, more so than the very first show I did here, which was about technically being in the right place and seeing if the lighting's okay. And, you know, I say to students if I'm teaching, you know, it's an illusion, I think, that you go on stage and you're 100% actor. You know, you can be 90% actor, but 10% of you has to be technical. Am I in the lighting? Am I talking loud enough over that piece of music? You know, you have to be technically aware of other actors and of other influences in the space. So for me, it's the joy of going, oh, I found a new movement. That will go brilliantly with that beat on that bar of the music. So it gets incredibly detailed, and hopefully that's even more enjoyable for an audience to sort of think. And those are terribly satisfying moments, you know. So for me, it gets the uncertainty goes to certainty and then into microscopic detail. So that's my journey. It's from a very large space to a very small pinprick.
But is one of the reasons you bring it, say, to the Edinburgh Fringe, is that you are confident in it, but here it's intense, it's a month. You never get more potential press coverage in one space. So you kind of come up here for a bit of uncertainty.
Yeah, that makes me sound like I'm an addict that wants to give up smoking. You know, it's I wouldn't. That's not strictly true. I do feel that I've changed my mind recently. We've talked about it. I think you need to know why you're at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. If you're doing it because that's what you do every August, I think that's not a good plan. You need to know why you're here. And I would be honest with you in saying at the moment, I need more people to be buying tickets. I'm not having a great time this year, actually. You know, I've got fewer reviewers listed, and that's a concern. And I'm not quite sure what the analysis of that is yet. I'm trying to my inner producer is trying to not analyse the Edinburgh Fringe yet because it's only, you know, day six or whatever it is. But as a producer, you have all those worries. As a performer, you can enjoy yourself on a completely different level, so I just have to go with a slightly more positive version of myself at any given moment. But I wouldn't say I come here for this uncertainty. I know why I'm here. I want to sell the work and I want the show to have a life, but that's why it's frustrating if you're not perhaps selling as many tickets yet as you would like to be.
Okay, so you're not kind of morbidly wanting loads of opinion about it?
No, I think it's great. Maybe that is arrogance, but I think the two shows I'm presenting are just a fantastically interesting, intelligent, well-presented, authoritative pieces of work. And my only frustration, if I go back in 3 weeks having played to very, very small numbers, is that I would have liked more people to see what that is. You know, I want those ideas to be seen by people.
Final question, kind of looking forward, but also looking back over your kind of creative work. And the previous interview went right back to your childhood. But if we followed you around and we could see not only what you saw, but also what was going on in your mind, where do the ideas come from, the initial ideas? Where do you pluck them from?
I'm pretty sure you did ask me that before, and I think I said at the time, I don't know. So sometimes it's books. I find usually that I've been thinking about something for 2 or 3 years before it finally translates into, yes, I'm going to make a show based on that. And that is really the subconscious thing. I'm more and more... There's a thing up here this year called The Sick of the Fringe, which I discovered, which is a curated initiative at Summerhall, I think, it's about putting artists together, whoever wants to get together, that are doing something along the lines of physical health, mental health, or science-based work. I went to the first talk with Bryony Kimming, so I'm booked in next week to sit and listen to Simon McBurney. And that I find really intriguing and relevant to the show that I'm doing now, because Crusoe deals with loneliness and Alzheimer's and Big Bang Theory. And the next show, which I think might be Coincidence and String Theory. So that to me is like a little door opening. And if I go back from Edinburgh having not maybe sold as many tickets as I wanted to, but having gone through another door that offers different possibilities, that will be the reward of this year's Edinburgh. And I don't think I answered your question at all, but I think it's themes. I don't know where they come from. It can be a book like The Dice Man, or, you know, I did a show called I Am Who Am I because I was intrigued by what memory loss is and what, you know. So I think, yeah, it's just wherever it drops out the sky. And I'd be interested to know what other people say, but you just don't know where it's going to come.
But all that language, it suggests it comes from out there. I mean, it may manifest inside, but you get your ideas from in the world and the people you listen to. It's not coming from some mystical core.
Well, I would say that I am, as a person, I'm very drawn to mystery. So things like coincidence or memory, things that are intriguing and can't be very easily explained, I find fascinating. So that, I suppose, in terms of my natural inner self, I'm very drawn to things that can't be easily explained. You know, the supernatural, ghosts, coincidence, what's that, probability, parallel universes, those things are fascinating. So that's my inner world that is just there all the time. But something else from outside can certainly spark that off and turn it into something which wants to be on stage, yeah.
Inner and outer, and we did see Crusoe in an early stage, and it got highly recommended from Fringe Review a couple of years back, and it's back on the Fringe, even further developed, so do go and see it. Thanks very much.